Seattle.
Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse's widow and five children agree that Dad did something in the war, and that's about all. Each of them seems to have a different 1950s B-movie or 1940s movie-tone newsreel in his or her head, portraying a rather different set of events. There is not even agreement on whether he was in the Army or the Navy, which seems like a pretty fundamental plot point to Randy. Was he in Europe or Asia? Opinions differ. Grandma grew up on an outback sheep farm. One might think, therefore, that at some point in her life, she might have been an earthy cuss, the type of woman who would not only remember which service her late husband had been in, but would be able to take down his rifle from the attic and field strip it blindfolded. But she had evidently spent something like 75% of her waking hours in church, where she not only worshipped but went to school and transacted essentially all of her social life, or in transit thereto or therefrom, and her own parents quite explicitly did not want her to wind up living on a farm, ramming her arm up livestock vaginas and slapping raw steaks over the black eyes dished out by some husband. Farming might have been an adequate sort of booby prize for one or at most two of their sons, sort of a fallback for any offspring who happened to suffer major head injuries or fall into chronic alcoholism, but the real purpose of the Skamithid kids was to restore the past and lost glories of the family, who allegedly had been major wool brokers around the time of Shakespeare and well on their way to living in Kensington and spelling their names Smith, before some combination of scrapey, long-term climactic change, nefandous conduct by jealous outer Tagmians, and a worldwide shift in fashions away from funny-smelling 30-pound sweaters with small arthropods living in them, had driven them all into honest poverty and then not-so-honest poverty and led to their forcible transportation to Australia. The point here being that Grandma was incarnated, indoctrinated, and groomed by her Ma to wear stockings and lipstick and gloves in a big city somewhere. The experiment had succeeded to the point where Mary Skamithid could, at any point in her post-adolescent life, have prepared and served high tea to the Queen of England on 10 minutes' notice, flawlessly, without having to even glance in a mirror, straighten up her dwelling, polish any silver, or bone up on any etiquette. It had been a standing joke among her male offspring that Mom could walk unescorted into any biker bar in the world and simply by her bearing and appearance cause all ongoing fistfights to be instantly suspended, all grubby elbows to be removed from the bar, postures to straighten, salty language to be choked off. The bikers would climb over one another's backs to take her coat, pull her chair back, address her as ma'am, etc. Though it had never been performed, this biker bar scene was like a whole sort of virtual or notional comedy sketch that was a famous moment in entertainment for the Waterhouse family, like the Beatles on Ed Sullivan or Belushi doing a samurai bit on Saturday Night Live. It was up there on their mental video cassette shelves, right next to their imaginary newsreels and B-movies of what the patriarch had done in the war. The bottom line was that the ability to run a house in the way Grandma was legendary or infamous for doing, to keep the personal grooming up to that standard, to send out a few hundred Christmas cards every year, each written in flawless fountain pen longhand, etc., etc., that all of these things taken together took up as much space in her brain as, say, mathematics might take up in a theoretical physicist's. And so when it came to anything of a practical nature, she was perfectly helpless, and probably always had been. Until she had gotten too old to drive, she had continued to tool around Whitman in the 1965 Lincoln Continental, which was the last vehicle her husband had purchased, from Whitman's Patterson Lincoln Mercury before his untimely death. The vehicle weighed something like 6,000 pounds and had more moving parts than a silo full of Swiss watches. Whenever any of her offspring came to visit, someone would discreetly slip out to the garage to yank the dipstick, which would always be mysteriously topped up with clear amber-colored 10W-40. It eventually turned out that her late husband had summoned the entire living male lineage of the Patterson family, 4 generations of them, into his hospital room and gathered them around his deathbed and wrought some kind of unspecified pact with them, along the general lines of that if at any point in the future the tire pressure in the Lincoln dropped below spec or the maintenance in any other way lapsed, all of the Pattersons would not merely sacrifice their immortal souls, but literally be pulled out of meetings or lavatories and dragged off to hell on the spot, like Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. He knew that his wife had only the vaguest idea of what a tire was, other than something that from time to time a man would heroically jump out of the car and change while she sat inside the car admiring him. The world of physical objects seemed to have been made solely for the purpose of giving the men around Grandma something to do with their hands. And not, mind you, for any practical reason, but purely so that Grandma could twiddle those men's emotional knobs by reacting to how well or poorly they did it. Which was a fine setup, as long as men were actually around, but not so good after Grandpa died. So, guerrilla mechanic teams had been surveilling Randy's grandmother ever since, and occasionally swiping her Lincoln from the church parking lot on Sunday mornings, and taking it down to Patterson's for Sub Rosa oil changes. The ability of the Lincoln to run flawlessly for a quarter of a century without maintenance, without even putting gasoline in the tank, had only confirmed grandmother's opinions about the amusing superfluity of male pursuits. In any event, what it all came down to was that Grandma, whose grasp of practical matters had only declined, if that was even possible, with advanced age, was not the sort of person you would go to for information about her late husband's war record. Defeating the Nazis was in the same category as changing a flat tire, an untidy business that men were expected to know how to do. And not just the men of yore, the supermen of her generation. Randy was expected to know about these things, too. If the Axis reconstituted itself tomorrow, Grandma would expect Randy to be suited up behind the controls of a supersonic fighter plane the day after that. And Randy would sooner spiral into the ground at Mach 2 than bear her tidings that he wasn't up to the job. Luckily for Randy, who has recently become intensely curious about Grandpa, an old suitcase has been unearthed. It's a rattan and leather thing, sort of a snappy, roaring 20s number, complete with some badly abraded hotel stickers, plotting Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse's migration from the Midwest to Princeton and back, which is completely filled with small black-and-white photographs. Randy's father dumps the contents out on a ping-pong table that inexplicably sits in the center of the rec room at Grandma's managed care facility, whose residents are about as likely to play ping-pong as they are to get their nipples pierced. The photos are messed out into several discrete piles, which are in turn sorted through by Randy and his father and his aunts and uncles. Most of them are photos of the Waterhouse kids, so everyone's fascinated until they have found pictures of themselves at a couple of different ages. Then the pile of photos begins to look depressingly large. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse was evidently a shutterbug of sorts, and now his offspring are paying the price. Randy has a different set of motives, and so he stays there late, going through pictures by himself. 99 out of 100 are snapshots of Waterhouse brats from the 1950s, but some are older. He finds a photo of Grandpa in a place with palm trees, in a military uniform, with a big, white, disc-shaped officer's cap on his head. 3 hours later, he comes across a picture of a very young Grandpa, really just a turkey-necked adolescent, costumed in grown-up clothes, standing in front of a Gothic building with two other men, a grinning dark-haired chap who looks vaguely familiar, and an aquiline blonde fellow in rimless glasses. All three men have bicycles. Grandpa is straddling his, and the other two, perhaps considering this to be not so dignified, are supporting theirs with their hands. Another hour goes by, and then there's Grandpa in a khaki uniform with more palm trees in the background. The next morning, he sits down next to his grandmother, after she has finished her daily hour-long getting-out-of-bed ritual. "Grandmother, I found these two old photographs." He deals them out on the table in front of her, and gives her a few moments to switch contexts. Grandma doesn't turn on a dime conversationally, and besides, those stiff old lady corneas take a little while to shift focus.
"Yes, these are both Lawrence when he was in the service."
Grandmother has always had this knack for telling people the obvious in a way that is scrupulously polite, but that makes the recipient feel like a butthead for having wasted her time. By this point, she is obviously tired of IDing photographs, a tedious job with an obvious subtext of, "You're going to die soon, and we were curious. Who is this lady standing next to the Buick?" A grandmother? Randy says brightly, trying to rouse her interest. In this photo here, he is wearing a Navy uniform, and in this photo here, he is wearing an Army uniform. Grandma Waterhouse raises her eyebrows and looks at him with the synthetic interest she would use if she were at a formal affair of some kind, and some man she had just met tried to give her a tutorial on tire changing. It is, I think, kind of unusual, Randy says, for a man to be in both the Army and the Navy during the same war. Usually it's one or the other.
Lawrence had both an Army uniform and a Navy uniform, Grandmother says, in the same tone she'd used to say he had both a small intestine and a large intestine. And he would wear whichever one was appropriate.
Of course he would, Randy says. The laminar wind is gliding over the highway like a crisp sheet being stripped from a bed, and Randy's finding it hard to keep the Acura on the pavement. The wind isn't strong enough to blow the car around, but it obscures the edges of the road. All he can see is this white striated plane sliding laterally beneath him. His eye tells him to steer into it, which would be a bad idea since it would take him and Amy straight into the lava fields. He tries to focus on a distant point, the white diamond of Mount Rainier, a couple of 100 kilometers west. I don't even know when they got married, Randy says. Isn't that horrible?
September 1945, Amy says. I dragged it out of her.
Wow!
Girl talk.
I didn't know you were even rigged for girl talk.
We can all do it.
Did you learn anything else about the wedding, like
the china pattern?
Yeah.
It was, in fact, lavender rose,
Amy says. So it fits. I mean, it fits chronologically. The submarine went down in May of 1945, off of Palawan, 4 months before the wedding. Knowing my grandmother, wedding preparations would have been well advanced by that point. They definitely would have settled on a china pattern.
And you think you have a photo of your grandpa in Manila around that time?
It's definitely Manila. And Manila wasn't liberated until March of 45.
So what do we have then? Your grandpa must have had some kind of connection with someone on that U-boat between March and May.
A pair of eyeglasses was found on the U-boat.
Randy pulls a photo out of his shirt pocket and hands it across to Amy. I'd be interested to know if they match the specs on that guy, the tall blonde.
I can check it out when I go back. Is the geek on the left your grandpa?
Yeah.
Who's the geek in the middle?
I think it's Turing.
Turing? As in Turing Magazine?
They named the magazine after him because he did a lot of early work with computers, Randy says.
Like your grandpa did?
Yeah.
How about this guy we're going to see in Seattle? He's a computer guy, too?
Oh, you're getting this look on your face like Amy just said something so stupid it caused me physical pain.
Is this a common facial expression among the men in your family? Do you think it is the expression that your grandfather wore when your grandmother came home and announced that she had backed the Lincoln Continental into a fire hydrant?
I am sorry if I make you feel bad sometimes, Randy says. The family is full of scientists, mathematicians. The least intelligent of us become engineers, which is sort of what I am.
Excuse me, did you just say you are one of the least intelligent?
Least focused, maybe? My point is that precision and getting things right in the mathematical sense is the one thing we have going for us. Everyone has to have a way of getting ahead, right? Otherwise you end up working at McDonald's your whole life, or worse. Some are born rich, some are born into a big family like yours. We make our way in the world by knowing that 2 + 2 = 4 and sticking to our guns in a way that is kind of nerdy, and that maybe hurts people's feelings sometimes. I'm sorry.
Hurts whose feelings? People who think that 2 + 2 = 5?
People who put a higher priority on social graces than on having every statement uttered in a conversation be literally true.
Like, for example, female people?
Randy grinds his teeth for about a mile and then says, if there is any generalization at all that you can draw about how men think versus how women think, I believe it is that men can narrow themselves down to this incredibly narrow laser beam focus on one tiny little subject and think about nothing else.
Whereas women can't?
Well, I suppose women can. They rarely seem to want to. What I'm characterizing here as the female approach is essentially saner and healthier. See, you are being a little paranoid here and focusing on the negative too much. It's not about how women are deficient. It's more about how men are deficient. Our social deficiencies, lack of perspective, or whatever you want to call it, is what enables us to study one species of dragonfly for 20 years or sit in front of a computer for 100 hours a week writing code. This is not the behavior of a well-balanced and healthy person, but it can obviously lead to great advances in synthetic fibers, or whatever.
But you said that you yourself were not very focused.
Compared to other men in my family, that's true. So, I know a little about astronomy, a lot about computers, a little about business, and I have, if I may say so, a slightly higher level of social functioning than the others. Or maybe it's not even functioning, just an acute awareness of when I'm not functioning, so that I at least know when to feel embarrassed.
Amy laughs. You're definitely good at that. It seems like you sort of lurch from one moment of feeling embarrassed to the next.
Randy gets embarrassed.
It's fun to watch, Amy says encouragingly. It speaks well of you.
What I'm saying is that this does set me apart. One of the most frightening things about your true nerd for many people is not that he's socially inept, because everybody's been there, but rather his complete lack of embarrassment about it.
Which is still kind of pathetic.
It was pathetic when they were in high school, Randy says. Now it's something else, something very different from pathetic.
What then?
I don't know. There is no word for it. You'll see. Driving over the Cascades produces a climactic transition that would normally require a 4-hour airplane flight. Warm rain spatters the windshield and loosens the rinds of ice on the wipers. The gradual surprises of March and April are compressed into a terse executive summary. It is about as tantalizing as a striptease video played on Fast Forward. The landscape turns wet and so green it's almost blue and bolts straight up out of the soil in the space of about a mile. The fast lanes of Interstate 90 are strewn with brown snow turds melted loose from homebound skiers' Broncos. Semis plummet past them in writhing conical shrouds of water and stream. Randy startled to see new office buildings halfway up the foothills, sporting high-tech logos. Then he wonders why he startled. Amy has never been here, and she takes her feet down from the airbag deployment panel and sits up straight to look, wishing out loud that Robin and Marcus Aurelius had come along instead of turning back towards Tennessee. Randy remembers to glide over into the right lanes and slow down as they shed the last 1,000 feet of altitude into Issaquah. And sure enough, the highway patrol is out there ticketing speeders. Amy's duly impressed by this display of acumen. They are still miles outside of the city core, in the half-forested suburbs of the east side, where street and avenue numbers are up in the triple digits. When Randy pulls onto an exit ramp and drives them down a long commercial strip that turns out to be just the sphere of influence of a big mall. Several satellite malls have burst from the asphalt all around it, wiping out old landmarks and screwing up Randy's navigation. Everything is crowded because people are out returning their Christmas gifts. After a little bit of driving around and cursing, Randy finds the Core Mall, which looks a little shabby compared to its satellites. He parks in the far corner of the lot, explaining that it is more logical to do this and then walk for 15 seconds than it is to spend 15 minutes looking for a closer space. Randy and Amy stand behind the Acura's open trunk for a minute, peeling off layers of suddenly gratuitous Eastern Washington insulation. Amy frets about her cousins and wishes that she and Randy had donated all of their cold weather gear to them. When last seen, they were circling the Impala like a pair of carrier-based fighter aircraft orbiting their mothership in preparation for landing, checking tire pressures and fluid levels with an intensity and alertness that made it seem as if they were about to do something much more exciting than settle their asses into bucket seats and drive east for a couple of days. They have a gallant style about them that must knock the girls dead back home. Amy hugged them both passionately, as if she'd never see them again, and they accepted her hugs with dignity and forbearance.
and then they were gone, resisting the urge to lay a patch until they were a couple of blocks distant. They go into the mall, Amy still wondering aloud why they are here, but game. Randy is a little bit turned around, but eventually homes in on a dimly heard electronic cacophony, digitized voices prophesying war, and emerges into the mall's food court. Navigating now, partly by sound and partly by smell, he comes to the corner where a lot of males, ranging from perhaps 10 to 40 years old, are seated in small clusters, some extracting quivering chopstick loads of Szechuan from little white boxes, but most fixated on what, from a distance, looks like some kind of paperwork. As backdrop, the ultraviolet maw of a vast game arcade spews digitized and sound lab-sweetened detonations, whooshes, sonic booms, and gatling farts. But the arcade seems nothing more than a defunct landmark around which is gathered this intense cult of paperwork hobbyists. A wiry teenager in tight black jeans and a black T-shirt prowls among the tables with the provocative confidence of a pool hustler, a long, skinny cardboard box slung over his shoulder like a rifle. "These are my ethnic group," Randy explains in response to the look on Amy's face. "Fantasy role-playing gamers. This is Avi and me, 10 years ago."
"They look like they're playing cards."
Amy looks again and wrinkles her nose.
"Weird cards."
Amy barges curiously into the middle of a four-nerd game. Almost anywhere else, the appearance of a female with discernible waist among these guys would cause some kind of a stir. Their eyes would at least travel rudely up and down her body. But these guys only think about one thing, the cards in their hands, each contained in a clear plastic sleeve to keep it mint condition, each decorated with a picture of a troll or wizard or some other leaf on the post-Tolkienian evolutionary tree, and printed on the back with elaborate rules. Mentally, these guys are not in a mall on the east side of Greater Seattle. They are on a mountain pass trying to kill each other with edged weapons and numinous fire. The young hustler is sizing Randy up as a potential customer. His box is long enough to contain a few hundred cards, and it looks heavy. Randy would not be surprised to learn something depressing about this kid, like he makes so much money from buying cards low and selling them high that he owns a brand new Lexus he's too young to drive. Randy catches his eye and asks, "Chester, bathroom." Randy sits down and watches Amy watching the nerds play their game. He thought he'd hit bottom in Whitman, out there on the parking lot, that surely she would get scared and flee. But this is potentially worse. A bunch of tubby guys who never go outside, working themselves into a frenzy over elaborate games in which non-existent characters go out and do pretend things that mostly are not as interesting as what Amy, her father, and various other members of her family do all the time without making any fuss about it. It is almost like Randy is deliberately hammering away at Amy, trying to find out when she'll break and run. But her lip hasn't started to writhe nauseously yet. She's watching the game impartially, peeking over the nerd's shoulders, following the action, occasionally squinting at some abstraction in the rules.
"Hey, Randy."
"Hey, Chester." So Chester's back from the bathroom. He looks exactly like the Chester of old, except spread out over a somewhat larger volume, like the classic demo of the expanding universe theory in which a face, or some other figure, is drawn on a partly inflated balloon which is then inflated some more. The pores have gotten larger, and the individual shafts of hair farther apart, which produces an illusion of impending baldness. It seems like even his eyes have gotten farther apart, and the flecks of color in the irises grown into blotches. He is not necessarily fat. He has the same rumpled heftiness he used to. Since people do not literally grow after their late teens, this must be an illusion. Older people seem to take up a larger space in the room. Or maybe older people see more.
"How's Avid?"
"As avid as ever," Randy says, which is lame but obligatory. Chester is wearing a sort of photographer's vest with a gratuitous number of small pockets, each of which is stuffed with gaming cards. Maybe that's why he seems big. He has, like, 20 pounds of cards strapped to him.
I note that you have made the transition to card-based RPGs, Randy says.
Oh, yeah. It is so much better than the old pencil and paper way. Or even computer-mediated RPGs, with all due respect to the fine work that you and Avi did. What are you working on now?
Something that might actually be relevant to this, Randy says. I was just realizing that if you have a set of cryptographic protocols suitable for issuing an electronic currency that cannot be counterfeited, which, oddly enough, we do, you could adapt those same protocols to card games, because each one of these cards is like a banknote, some more valuable than others. Chester nods all the way through this, but does not rudely interrupt Randy, as a younger nerd would. Your younger nerd takes offense quickly when someone near him begins to utter declarative sentences because he reads into it an assertion that he, the nerd, does not already know the information being imparted. But your older nerd has more self-confidence and, besides, understands that frequently people need to think out loud. And highly advanced nerds will furthermore understand that uttering declarative sentences, whose contents are already known to all present, is part of the social process of making conversation and therefore should not be construed as aggression under any circumstances.
It's already being done, Chester says, when Randy's finished. In fact, that company you and Avi worked for in Minneapolis is one of the leaders.
I'd like you to meet my friend Amy,
Randy interrupts, even though Amy is a good distance away and not paying attention. But Randy is afraid that Chester's about to tell him that stock in that Minneapolis company is now up to the point where its market capitalization exceeds that of General Dynamics and that Randy should have held on to his shares.
Amy, this is my friend Chester, Randy says,
leading Chester between tables. At this point, some of the gamers actually do look up interestedly, not at Amy, but at Chester, who, Randy infers, has probably got some one-of-a-kind cards tucked away in that vest, like the thermonuclear arsenal of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or Yahweh. Chester exhibits a marked improvement in social skills, shaking Amy's hand with no trace of awkwardness and dropping smoothly into a pretty decent imitation of a mature and well-rounded individual engaging in polite small talk. Before Randy knows it, Chester has invited them over to his house.
I heard it wasn't done yet, Randy says.
You must have seen the article in The Economist, Chester says.
Well, that's right.
If you'd seen the article in The New York Times, you'd know that the article in The Economist was wrong. I am now living in the house.
Well, it'd be fun to see it, Randy says.
Notice how well paved my street is,
Chester says sourly, half an hour later. Randy has parked his hammered and scraped Acura in the guest parking lot of Chester's house, and Chester has parked his 1932 Duesenberg Roadster in the garage, between a Lamborghini and some other vehicle that would appear to be literally an aircraft built to hover on ducted fans.
I can't say that I did,
Randy says, trying not to gape at anything. Even the pavement under his feet is some kind of custom-made mosaic of Penrose tiles.
I sort of vaguely remember it as being broad and flat and not having any chuck holes. Well paved, in other words.
This, Chester says, head faking towards his house, was the first house to trigger the LOHO.
LOHO?
The Ludicrously Oversized Home Ordinance. Some malcontents rammed it through the city council. You get these, like, cardiovascular surgeons and trust fund parasites who like to have big houses, but God forbid some dirty hacker should try to build a house of his own and send a few cement trucks down their street occasionally.
They made you repave the street?
They made me repave half the fucking town, Chester says. I mean, some of the neighbors were griping that the house was an eyesore, but after we got off on the wrong foot, my attitude was, to hell with them.
Indeed, Chester's house does resemble nothing so much as a regional trucking hub with a roof made entirely of glass. He waves his arm down a patchily turfed slab of mud that slopes down into Lake Washington.
Obviously, the landscaping hasn't even begun yet, so it looks like a science fair project on erosion.
I was going to say the Battle of the Somme, Randy says. Not as good an analogy because there are no trenches, Chester says. He is still pointing down towards the lake. But if you look near the waterline, you can just make out some railroad ties, half buried. That's where we laid the tracks.
Tracks? Amy says, the only word she's been able to get out of her mouth since Randy drove his Acura through the main gate. Randy told her on the way over here that if he, Randy, had $100,000 for every order of magnitude by which Chester's net worth currently exceeds his, then he, Randy, would never have to work again. This turned out to be more clever than informative, and so Amy was not prepared for what they have found here and is still steepling her eyebrows.
For the locomotive, Chester says. There are no railway lines nearby, so we barged the locomotive in and then winched it up a short railway into the foyer.
Amy just scrunches up her face, silent. Amy hasn't seen the articles, Randy says.
Oh, sorry, Chester says. I'm into obsolete technology. The house is a museum of dead tech. Stick your hand into these things.
Lined up before the front entrance are four waist-high pedestals emblazoned with the Novus Ordo Seclorum eyeball pyramid logo, with outlines of hands stenciled onto their lids and knobs in the lagoons between the fingers. Randy fits his hand into place and feels the knobs slide in their grooves, reading and memorizing the geometry of his hand.
The house knows who you are now, Chester says, typing their names into a ruggedized, weatherproofed keyboard. And I'm giving you a certain privileged constellation that I use for personal guests. Now you can come in through the main gate and park your car and wander around the grounds whether or not I'm home. And you can enter the house if I'm home, but if I'm not home, it'll be locked to you. And you can wander freely in the house, except for certain offices where I keep proprietary corporate documents.
You have your own company or something? Amy says weakly.
No. After Randy and Abby left town, I dropped out of college and snagged a job with a local company, which I still have, Chester says.
The front door, a translucent crystal slab on a track, slides open. Randy and Amy follow Chester into his house. As advertised, there is a full-scale steam locomotive in the foyer.
The house is patterned after flex space, Chester says.
What's that? Amy asks. She is completely turned off by the locomotive.
A lot of high-tech companies get started in flex space, which just means a big warehouse with no internal walls or partitions, just a few pillars to hold up the ceiling. You can drag partitions around to divide it up into rooms.
Like cubicles?
Same idea, but the partitions go up higher so you have a feeling of being in a real room. Of course, they don't go all the way up to the ceiling. Otherwise, there wouldn't be room for the TWA.
The what?
Amy asks. Chester, who is leading them into the maze of partitions, answers the question by tilting his head back and looking straight up. The roof of the house is made entirely of glass, held up by a trusswork of white-painted steel tubes. It is maybe 40 or 50 feet above the floor. The partitions rise to a height of maybe 12 feet. In the gap above the partitions and below the ceiling, a grid has been constructed. A scaffolding of red pipes, nearly as vast as the house itself. Thousands, millions of aluminum shreds are trapped in that space grid, like torn tufts caught in a three-dimensional screen. It looks like an artillery shell the length of a football field that has exploded into shrapnel a microsecond ago and been frozen in place. Light filters through the metal scraps, trickles down bundles of shredded wiring and glances flatly off the crusts of melted and hardened upholstery. It is so vast and so close that when Amy and Randy first look up at it, they flinch, expecting it to fall on them. Randy already knows what it is, but Amy has to stare at it for a long time and prowl from room to room, viewing it from different angles, before it takes shape in her mind and becomes recognizable as something familiar. A 747.
The FAA and NTSB were surprisingly cool about it, Chester muses. Which makes sense. I mean, they've reconstructed this thing in a hangar, right? Dredged up all the pieces, figured out where they go, and hung them on this grid. They've gone over it and gathered all the forensic evidence they could find, hosed out all the human remains and disposed of them properly, sterilized the debris so that the crash investigation team doesn't have to worry about getting AIDS from touching a bloody flange or something. And they're done with it. And they're paying like rent on this hangar. They can't throw it away. They have to store it somewhere. So all I had to do was get the house certified as a federal warehouse, which was a pretty easy legal hack. And if there's a lawsuit, I have to let the lawyers in to go over it. But really, it was not a problem to do this. The Boeing guys love it. They're over here all the time.
It's like a resource to them, Randy guesses.
Yeah.
You like to play that role.
Sure. I have defined a privileged constellation specifically for engineer types who can come over here anytime they want to access the house as a museum of dead tech. That's what I mean by the flex space analogy. To me and my guests, it's a home. To these visitors, there's one right there.
Chester waves his arm across the room. It is a central room, maybe 50 meters on a side. At an engineer type who has set up a Hasselblad on a huge tripod and is pointing it straight up at a bent landing gear strut.
To them, it's exactly like a museum in that there are places they can go and other places that if they step over the line will set off alarms and get them in trouble.
Is there a gift shop? Amy jokes.
The gift shop is roughed in, but not up and running. The LOHO throws up all kinds of impediments,
Chester grumbles. They end up in a relatively cozy glass-walled room with a view across the churned mud to the lake. Chester fires up an espresso machine that looks like a scale model of an oil refinery and generates a brace of lattes. This room happens to be underneath the TWA's left wingtip, which is relatively intact. Randy realizes now that the entire plane has been hung in a gentle banking attitude, like it's making an imperceptible course change, which is not really appropriate. A vertical dive would make more sense, but then the house would have to be 50 stories high to accommodate it. He can see a repeating pattern of tears in the wing's skin that seems to be an expression of the same underlying math that generates repeating vortices in a wake, or swirls in a Mandelbrot set. Charlene and his friends used to heckle him for being a platonist, but everywhere he goes, he sees the same few ideal forms shadowed in the physical world. Maybe he's just stupid or something. The house lacks a woman's touch. Randy gathers from hints dropped by Chester that the TWA has not turned out to be the conversation starter that he had hoped it would be. He is considering building fake ceilings over some of the house's partitions so that they will feel more like rooms, which, he admits, might make some people feel more comfortable there and open the possibility of their committing themselves to an extended stay. So, evidently, he is in early negotiations with some kind of female, which is good news. Chester, 2 years ago you sent me email about a project you were launching to build replicas of early computers. You wanted information about my grandfather's work?
Yeah, Chester says. You want to see that stuff? It's been on the back burner, but I just inherited some of his notebooks, Randy says.
Chester's eyebrows go up. Amy glances out the window. Her hair, skin, and clothes take on a pronounced reddish tinge from Doppler effect as she drops out of the conversation at relativistic velocity.
I want to know if you have a functioning ETC card reader.
Chester snorts.
That's all?
That's all.
You want a 1932 Mark III card reader or a 1938 Mark IV? Or a...
Does it make any difference? They all read the same cards, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
I have some cards from circa 1945 that I would like to have read out onto a floppy disk that I can take home. Chester picks up a cell phone the size of a gherkin and begins to prod it.
I'll call my card man, he says. Retired ETC engineer. Lives on Mercer Island. Comes up here on his boat a couple of times a week and tinkers with this stuff. He'll be really excited to meet you.
While Chester is conversing with his card man, Amy meets Randy's eyes and gives him a look that is almost perfectly unreadable. She seems a bit deflated, worn down, ready to go home. Her very unwillingness to show her feelings confirms this. Before this trip, Amy would have agreed that it takes all kinds to make a world. She'd still assent to it now. But Randy's been showing her some practical applications of that concept in the last few days that are going to take her a while to fit into her world view.
or more importantly, into her Randy view. And sure enough, the moment Chester's off the phone, she's asking if she can use it to call the airlines. There is only a momentary upward flick of the eyes towards the TWA. And once Chester gets over his astonishment that anyone still uses voice technology to make airline reservations in this day and age, he takes her to the nearest computer. There is a fully outfitted Unix machine in every room, and patches into the airline databases directly and begins searching for the optimal route back home. Randy goes and stares out the window at the chilly whitecaps slapping the mud shore and fights the urge to just stay here in Seattle, which is a town where he could be very happy. Behind him, Chester and Amy keep saying Manila, and it sounds ridiculously exotic and hard to reach. Randy thinks that he is marginally smarter than Chester and would be even richer if he'd only stayed here. A fast white boat comes larruping around the point from the direction of Mercer Island and banks towards him. Randy sets down his cold coffee and goes out to his car and retrieves a certain trunk, a lovely gift from a delighted Aunt Nina. It is full of certain old treasures, like his grandfather's high school physics notebooks. He sets aside, for example, a box labeled Harvard Waterhouse Prime Factor Challenge 49-52 to reveal a stack of bricks, neatly wrapped in paper that has gone gold with age, each consisting of a short stack of ETC cards, and each labeled Arethusa Intercepts, with a date from 1944 or 45. They have been in suspended animation for more than 50 years, stored on a dead medium, and now Randy is going to breathe life into them again, and maybe send them out on the net, a few strands of fossil DNA broken out of their amber shells and released in the world again. Probably they will fail and die, but if they flourish, it should make Randy's life a little more interesting. Not that it's devoid of interest now, but it is easier to introduce new complications than to resolve the old ones.